Taped from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
Johnny boy, how are you, good friend?
I'm doing well. We caught up a little before we officially started recording. It sounded like you're doing okay.
Yeah, so we did a little pre-show banter, as they say in the biz, people.
Yeah. Yeah, our pre-show banter is unmatched in the biz.
Oh my God, our pre-show, it's tops. Tops, I tells you.
Gold, pure gold.
Yeah, we're just talking about stuff we've been catching up on. I finally watched Fleabag, so you know I get the hype now. We've been talking about Community, I've been rewatching that.
Yeah, well. I just finished watching, rewatching. / watching all of Community because I never got to finish the series because when it was on Yahoo Screen, so I finally got to see the finish of that show.
Yeah,
and that was interesting.
That was definitely a show.
Well, I mean, I am unmatched in my love of Community. Like the first three seasons, I think are just about perfect. With you know the odd stray episode here and there, but I feel like it never quite got its mojo back. After the whole Dan Harmon brouhaha, you know, even after he came back to the show.
Yeah, that was a debacle. I mean, I remember when that happened. It wasn't too long ago. It's like, what, less than 10 years. And like once, once he left the show, it just never got its footing back. One would say maybe it was like when Matt Sharp left Weezer. But, you know, that's another the argument for another time.
I can see that. I can see that. Yeah, and then I mean, just the them losing the show's creator and driving force, it really just put the show on a, I don't want to say a bad path because like there are things in the fourth season I like, but it wasn't the same show.
Yes,
and it wasn't quite what the show had been, and it didn't have the same guiding force, and that was pretty apparent. And then after he came back, we started having cast changes, and that really put the show off on a weird or different path. And yeah, so I'm a lot more mixed on the last three seasons, but it's still a very worthwhile show, I think.
Right. The Dick Ebersole years of Community, as it were.
That is the exact analogy that Ken Jeong used on the Darkest Timeline podcast.
No, did he really?
Yeah, seriously. I told Darren just before we started recording, I just started listening to the Darkest Timeline podcast that Joel McHale and Ken Jeong are doing. And Ken Jeong, he said that the fourth year of Community was kind of like the Dick Ebersole years of SNL.
Holy wow. Look at me and Ken Jeong sharing a brain.
Yeah. You would enjoy that podcast, I think.
I'll give it a shot.
I've also, the last few weeks, I've been enjoying another podcast, the Fake Doctors Real Friends podcast that Zach Braff and Donald Faison are doing about Scrubs.
Oh, nice.
And it is pretty cool. It's let me explain it if you haven't heard it. There are these two guys. They're best friends. We got a white guy and a black guy. They're best friends. And they do this podcast where they talk about this television show and they go off on lots of tangents.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never heard of such a concept, but it sounds
interesting. I mean, I think it is totally uncharted territory.
Yeah, this is, wow. They're really cornering the market here. I wonder where they got the idea to do such a podcast.
Don't know.
Huh.
Don't know.
Well, but, Mr. Braff, you'll be hearing from our lawyers, our legal team. Yes. Our legal team here at Not Productive, so you better lawyer up.
Yeah, but it is an entertaining show. I do enjoy the podcast, and it's worth listening to, and it makes my commute to and from work go a little easier.
All right, that's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
Far out, and yeah, and I've also been listening to. I've also watched two things that have kind of been that are SNL related that have been kind of making the rounds, you know, throughout this. COVID-19, Black Lives Matter unrest that we're all living through. Two things that have been kind of resurfaced and are trending right now. Michael Che's stand-up, his Netflix special, Michael Che Matters, and Chris Rock's Netflix special, A Tambourine. They both have Well, Michael Che has a joke about, you know, Black Lives Matter, and you know, basically, I don't want to ruin it or nothing, but like, you've been seeing that's been making the rounds on Twitter and stuff, just, you know, because it came out in 2016, but still relevant. And also, Chris Rock has a police brutality segment in his stand-up special, and still relevant, you know, about you know, cops always saying there's only a few bad apples. It's not everybody. That's me. It's a few bad apples. And then he said, well, there's a few jobs where you can't afford to have some bad apples.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, you can't have like some bad pilots.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Yes. That's a great bet. That's a great bet.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, both specials are good. Yeah. Go. I would highly recommend you check them out.
Yeah. Those are both on my Netflix queue, and I need to watch them. I'm just horribly behind on all my stand-up specials because Netflix has so many stand-up specials. It's almost too much of a good thing.
Yeah. It's pretty bonkers.
Yeah. Yeah. But and speaking of too much of a good thing,
I thought you were going to say speaking of a stand-up comics, because like that's, well, whatever.
That could also be a valid transition. But we're doing a Judd Apatow movie, so too much of a good thing seemed like a good way to transition into it. This week we are covering the Judd Apatow movie, The King of Staten Island, starring SNL's Pete Davidson.
Yes, directed by Judd Apatow, written by Apatow, and Dave Cyrus, who we had on this podcast not too long ago.
That's right, yeah. We had a cool bonus episode where Dave talked about his career in stand-up and writing for SNL and writing this movie, and you can watch it without seeing the movie because we hadn't seen the movie when we conducted the interview, so it's spoiler-free. And, but we're going to get into it more in this podcast. We both seen the movie now, and we're going to give our unfiltered reactions.
Right. So this episode is going to have some spoilers in it. So yeah. If you haven't seen the movie, stop this podcast right now, go watch it, and then come back and listen to this podcast. But you've been warned, spoilers ahead.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can just keep it kind of general at first, and then we can have a spoiler point, and then we could do a time code where we have the spoilers.
Okay. I'm fine with that.
Does that work for you?
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, that's how like the big time podcasts do it.
Ooh, fancied.
I know. Well, let me read the summary that is on demand to start, because this was originally going to be released in theaters. I think the plan was they were going to release it in about 100 drive-in theaters, but at the last minute they pulled that, and now it's on demand only. So I just watched it this morning. So here's the summary, reading from my TV. Scott has achieved little besides smoking too much weed since his father died. A chain of events forces him to take some steps toward moving forward in life.
That's it?
And that's it.
Okay.
That's it. That is one vague-ass plot summary.
I thought you were pointing for like dramatic effect or something like that. I'm waiting for the rest.
I was not. That is it.
Huh. All right. There you go.
You know, so somebody was reading this and like, whoa, this movie has a chain of events? I am sold.
Somebody's like, I don't really like movies with chains of events. Is there something else?
I don't like it when the plot points and one thing affects another.
Okay. I was going to say, oh, then you'll like Zack Snyder films or something like that. That's mean. I shouldn't say that.
It's mean, but you're allowed to say it.
Slam dunk.
But, yeah, so, I mean, this movie is at least, I think it's fair to say, pretty autobiographical for Pete Davidson, because he's a young fellow from Staten Island. He's smokes a lot of weed. His father died when he was young. He's got a lot of tattoos.
Yeah, so, I mean, Pete Davidson plays Scott Carlin in this film. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's pretty much as you said. He's like a guy who, he's in his 20s, he's a high school dropout. He's kind of in a stunted adolescence right now. He's, you know, arrested development. Still lives at
home. But he's like 24.
Yeah, he's 24. And they also mentioned that he has like, you know, maybe he has mental issues. He has ADD and Crohn's, which I thought was
Crohn's disease, yes, which he helpfully explains for us at one point. At one point, Pete Davidson's character goes to a baseball game with some other people, and they're like, hey, do you want a hot dog? And he's like, oh, no, thanks. I have Crohn's disease. And they're like, what the hell is that? And he's like, oh, well, it's when your stomach lining screwed up and it makes you crap a lot. And they're like, you could have just said you didn't want a hot dog.
Well, you asked.
He's like, I'm trying to raise awareness.
You did. He did ask. Like, that's on him.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So Scott's character, his sister has just graduated from high school, and his sister Claire is played by Maude Apatow, who is Judd Apatow's daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Judd Apatow casting a family member—it's shocking.
There's interesting, interesting choice.
Yeah, and his mom is played by Marissa Tomei, Oscar winner Miss Marissa Tomei.
Yeah, she plays Margie.
Yeah, and she, of course, was widowed when Scott's firefighter dad died in a hotel fire when he was, like, rescuing some people and that. And she has been on her own for 17 years and raising her kids. So Scott's sister has never really known her father, and she's relatively well-adjusted. And Scott, who was 7 when his father died, he's screwed up in a lot of the ways that I think Pete Davidson will acknowledge that he is, in real life, screwed up.
Right. Like, I mean, they mentioned, like, how he's kind of, he has mental issues, and he's, like, on antidepressants and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he's just really just stuck right now in this, you know, this phase. Like, he doesn't know what to do next with his life. He kind of does have some ambition, because he's very good at art. He's a very good drawer. Yeah. He went to art school, but he dropped out. And he really wants to be a tattoo artist. That's like his big dream. His big dream that they say is he wants to open a tattoo parlor / restaurant called Ruby Tattoos Days.
Yes. Great name.
It's a good name. I mean, tattoo parlor / restaurant is not the worst idea I've ever heard, but it ain't great.
It is not great. And a few people in the movie point out to him that it is not a great idea. You know, you don't want to watch somebody get a tattoo while you're eating. That's gross.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. The more I think about it, like, yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah. So Scott, he spends a lot of time just hanging out with his buddies there on Staten Island. And they're similar people who just don't have a whole lot going on in their lives. So they just kind of sit around, they watch movies, they smoke a lot of weed. Scott, who's an aspiring tattoo artist, he's done practice tattoos on most of his friends, but they're not great.
Yeah, they're not quite as advanced as you'd want in your tattoos. A little childish. Yeah. And his friends are Oscar, who's played by a New York comic called Ricky Velez, and Igor and Richie.
Right. Igor is played by Moises Arias, and Richie is played by Lou Wilson.
Right. And also, at this point, we also learned that Scott is also kind of hooking up with his friend Kelsey, who they have known each other since fourth grade, but he doesn't want to get out that they're, like, hooking up and having the sexy time. And
They're keeping it on the down low. So they're, like, Scott kind of considers it like, oh, well, we're just friends who hook up. And Kelsey's like, well, I mean, is this a dating thing? This feels like this should be a dating thing. And Scott, he's not ready to make a commitment to that. I know Judd Apatow made a movie about a guy in Arrested Development who was forced to grow up over the course of the movie. Where does he get his ideas? I don't know.
Yeah, he's really, he's really, like, you know, swinging for the fences on this one. This is uncharted territory for him.
I know, right?
And also, I should mention that, Kelsey is played by Belle Powley, who has a really good Staten Island accent in this, and, like, it's even more impressive when you find out she's actually British. She's from the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like that. She said, I looked it up. She said she learned about doing that Staten Island accent from watching this reality show called Made in Staten Island.
Oh, well, that sounds like a good way to research it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, for those that don't know, like, Staten Island accent, it's kind of like a mix of Long Island, like Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and Jersey, like that type of vibe. And I think she nailed it down, like, pretty solidly. Like, you hear, like, the way she, you know, dresses and the way she sounds, she's like, oh, she's definitely, like, from Staten Island.
I mean, she is not someone I was familiar with, and so I had no idea that she was actually British. That's interesting. I'm not from Staten Island, but her accent sounded great to me.
Yeah. I think she's also been in, I'll look it up, she was in that Apple show, The Morning Show, and she's been in a few other things. Diary of a Teenage Girl. Yeah, I mean, those are the main things, but yeah, like, I mean, as far as voices goes, that's she's very impressive.
So Scott and his buddies, they're hanging out at the grounds of an abandoned orphanage,
as you do.
Or no, wait, this wasn't at the orphanage. This was, they were at, like, hanging out at the beach, and like a kid comes by, and they kind of befriend the kid, and they convince the kid, who's like 9, hey, let Scott practice doing a tattoo on you. And the kid's like, yeah, that sounds fine and dandy. Let's do that. And then, of course, as soon as he puts the needle on the kid's arm, the kid screams in pain. And he's like, no, I don't want to do this. And so now the kid has like this spastic line on his arm.
Yeah, apparently, you know, 9-year-olds aren't built for pain like that.
I guess not. Yeah, he was a really wussy 9-year-old. Just got upset.
It's like, man up, Harold. Come on.
Yeah. So this kid, Harold, he goes off to his dad, and then Marissa Tomei, Pete Davidson's mother, she gets an angry knock on the door from Ray Bishop, played by the stand-up comedian Bill Burr.
Bill Burr, I'm a huge fan of his stand-up, too. I'm like, so, like, when I heard he was in this movie, I was like, oh, this is going to be pretty good.
And Bill Burr is terrific in this movie. He's really good. He's pretty wonderful. And he's got a neat look. He's, you know, got the shaved head, and he's got this big mustache, a big burly mustache. It gives him a very distinct look.
Yeah. I mean, for those who don't know, like, Bill Burr, his stand-up style is, like, kind of very, you know, like, you know, angry white dude and whatnot. And, like, he plays anger really well. Like, if you've ever seen his stand-up or his, you know, animated show, F is for Family, he's good at being, like, that angry dude. But I think he also does something different in the movie where he kind of dials it back, and he's, like, he's able to play, like, a little bit more subdued version of himself, too, which you don't see him do that much, really.
Well, you know, a little of that goes a long way in a movie. So, yeah, I think it was good that he got different shades to play. But so Bill Burr's character of Ray, he's quite angry, and he's like, you know, you're getting this removed from my kid's arm, and you're going to pay for it. And Marissa Tomei's character... what was her character name? Margie. She works in a hospital, and she's like, okay, I can get this done. We got a laser at the hospital. We can get it removed and all that. And this eventually leads to her and Ray dating.
Right. Cause like, I think he like, after he got all the anger out of his system, he came back and he was like, hey, you know what? I'm sorry. I was flying off the handle. And hey, by the way, what are you doing? Can I get some coffee? You want to get some coffee or something? What's up, baby?
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, Marissa Tomei.
Yeah. Dude, shoot your shot.
Shoot your shot. But they discover that they have a lot in common. Ray is divorced. Margie is widowed. They both have kids. Ray has, like, these two young kids. He's got the 9-year-old Harold. And then younger sister who's like 7, I think.
Yeah, Kelly, I believe, is young.
Kelly, yeah, okay. And they really seem to click, and they start dating, and then eventually Margie reveals to Scott that she is dating, and he takes it well at first until he finds out that the man that his widowed mother is dating is also a firefighter.
Yeah, and then that kind of sets him off. I mean, I don't know. There's something about, like, Scott's character up until this point. Like, he's not 100% likable, really. I don't know if you found it, but, like, he's very, like, combative, and he's, like, he gets into a lot of fights with his friends. Like, he's very, like...
Yeah. He's got some anger issues. I mean, the opening scene of the movie is him just driving, and he's presumably stoned, I'm assuming. And he just, you see him just, like, close his eyes for a really long time while he's driving, which, yeah, not a good habit, not a good driving habit. And then he opens his eyes, and then he discovers he's about to, like, rear end somebody, and he, like, swerves his car. And he, yeah, so that right there, it's not the most likable way to introduce your protagonist of the movie. But it shows, like, you know, who he is, that he's not a guy who has it together. He's not a responsible guy. He doesn't have a whole lot of ambition outside of the really impractical restaurant tattoo idea.
Yeah, but I'm actually, like, so when you saw that, you saw him as him being stoned? Because, like, I didn't know if, like, he was just stoned and he just closed his eyes and just drove. I think he was on, like, the Staten Island Expressway. I don't know if that was him just being stoned or that was, like him trying to off himself. Like, was that, like, a suicide attempt or is it that him being stoned? Like, they leave it very vague.
That didn't occur to me, but, I mean, that could be a valid interpretation. Sure, yeah. I could see that.
Yeah, but either way, like, I mean, I don't know, like, for an Apatow film, I thought that was, like, a really kind of dark and serious way to start a movie. Like,
I would say this is Apatow's, like, most dramatic film.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. It's not, like, on a par with 40-Year-Old Virgin or Knocked Up. Comedy-wise, it's not as ha-ha funny. I mean, there are some funny moments in it, yes, but it mostly deals with, like, some dramatic stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I guess before this, the most serious he had gotten is maybe Funny People, I'd say, or This Is 40, you could say.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think
he's been on a steady like career arc where he's mixing in more and more dramatic stuff. So this is, I think the balance may be shifted more towards dramatic than to humorous.
He's taking the Adam McKay route.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I don't know. That was just a random thought I had. So we see him. He's kind of messed up around this, and he learns that his mom is dating a firefighter. He's very upset. It's like, oh, didn't you learn anything from the last time? Like, you know, dad's dead and that messed up this whole family. So now you're going to do the whole thing all over again? You know, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. And meanwhile, his sister, she's going off to college and she's, you know, going, her life is getting started. She's making something of herself. And Scott is still there at home and, you know, doesn't particularly want to get a job. He does get a job at a local restaurant when like one of his relatives, I think he was a cousin.
Yeah, his cousin Joe, played by Kevin Corrigan.
I love Kevin Corrigan. He's so great.
National treasure.
And it was particularly nice because I just finished that Community marathon. I was like, hey, it's Professorson. So, I enjoy Kevin Corrigan.
He's good stuff. And actually, yeah, so Scott's working as a busboy in a restaurant. And I think earlier on when we were talking, I mentioned that how there were like a ton of New York comics in this movie. And like in this scene, there's like two New York comics that work at the... Actually, no, there's one scene where there's like four New York comics in the restaurant scene. One of the guys at the waitstaff is Derek Gaines, who's a New York comic. You see Lisa Traeger, who's a New York comic. And at one point, a couple who's sitting at the restaurant wanting to order is Rich Voss and Bonnie McFarlane.
Yep. They got a lot of comedy people into this movie. So that was cool.
If you know the New York, you know, comedy scene, you'll see a lot. Like at one point, like you mentioned, they were hanging out at an abandoned orphanage, you know, and then they get a talking to from the guard of the abandoned orphanage. And the guard is Keith Robinson, who's like a comedy seller staple.
Yeah, if you ever watched Colin Quinn's old show, the debate show that he did, what was that called? I'm blanking on the name now.
Tough Crowd,
yeah. Keith Robinson was a regular on there.
Yeah. And also another comic, I don't know if you mentioned it, but she plays Joy, who's Margie's sister. It's Lynn Coplitz, who's also a New York comic.
Mm-hmm. So basically what we're saying is there are a lot of New York comics in this movie.
Yes, absolutely. Like, if you've ever been to the Cellar, you'll see, like, a Wednesday, the entire Wednesday lineup is in this movie.
So Ray and Margie, they're getting closer. Scott gets kind of intertwined into Ray's family. They recruit Scott to start walking Ray's kids to and from school because they're in two different schools that are far apart. And I was very pleasantly surprised to see a favorite actress of mine, Pamela Adlon, playing Gina, Ray's ex-wife.
Yeah, yeah. And,
she's good. I had no idea she was in this movie, and I was like, hey, Pamela Adlon, who I mainly know from when she was on Louie, but she's now, she's had her own show for the last few years, Better Things, and, I mean, she's just great.
Yeah, she's good stuff, and, I mean, it's not a huge role she has here, but she makes the most of this role, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agreed. I mean, she's got the goods, you know, she's great. She's also a very notable cartoon voice actor. She was the voice of the kid on King of the Hill for years and years and years, and she does a ton of cartoon voices.
Yes, Bobby Hill. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Bobby Hill, that's it. Yeah.
Right. What was it? Ray and Margie, they're, you know, like you said, they're getting close. Scott, you know, they kind of volunteered Scott to walk his kids back and forth to school, and that's what he's doing. And also, I think Ray is also trying to bond with Scott a little bit. So we see one scene where he's like, oh, yeah, let me take you to a Yankees game, you know. And then and then Scott's like, whoa, you got tickets to the Yankees? Oh, yeah, the Staten Island Yankees. I was like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, oh, yeah. Considerably less enthused. Yeah. I didn't even know that there was, like, a minor league team called the Staten Island Yankees, but...
Yeah, no, there is. It's, I mean, I think in New York City, there's, like, two minor league teams. There's the Brooklyn Cyclones that play in Coney Island and the Staten Island Yankees, which, yeah, like, now, not a lot of people go to minor league games, but, like, the few times I've been to them, I've had a great time.
Yeah, I'm sure they would be entertaining. I'm not looking down. I'm just rather ignorant of that world.
John, get off your high horse and stop being all upset at the minor league teams.
Okay, you're right. You make a good point.
Yeah, I'm the everyman, John. Like the I'm down with the common folks.
So when Scott, he goes out to the baseball game with Ray, he meets some of Ray's firefighter buddies, including. The head firefighter of the house, played by the great Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, he's always good, no matter what he does.
And Steve Buscemi, of course, was a real life New York City firefighter in the early 80s.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he very famously went and volunteered and helped out at his old house searching for survivors when 9/11 happened.
Oh, wow.
So hats off to Steve Buscemi. I mean, he's that's fucking awesome.
Oh, that I did not know. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And so when they're at the ball game trying to, you know, get to know each other, trying to break the ice, that's when the Crohn's comment comes into play. And I believe at one point Ray says, oh, have you ever thought about putting on the uniform being a firefighter? And that's when Scott's, he's kind of latched out. It's like, no, why would I do that? Like, that's a horrible thing to put your family through just to be a firefighter, you know. Put your family through thinking that one night you may not come home. That's so.
Yeah, because all Scott can see is he's just seen it through his prism of, like the family you left behind. I mean, that's a shitty thing to do. And like, I had a shitty childhood because my dad grew up my dad died when I was such a young kid. And that's a shitty way to grow up. So he's vehemently against being a firefighter.
Yeah, I mean, and as a, speaking as a son of a firefighter, I mean, I do get it. Like, I do understand, like, I mean, or anybody who's, mother or father is in a line of work that is, extremely dangerous, cop or, coal miner or what have you. There is that fear of, I hope they make it home okay. And
it's,
it is real. It's real.
Your dad is retired now, right, Darren?
He is retired, yes.
Okay. Well, that's great. How accurate do you feel like this movie was with the firefighter stuff? Did it depict the culture accurately, you think?
Yeah. I mean, from what I remember, like, I mean, a few times I've been to the firehouse when I was a kid, it was pretty much that. It was like a big camaraderie. There's, just that, the love of the uniform and that band of brothers type of vibe and just, feeling of honor and, doing a job well done and all that stuff. I think they got the tone just right.
That's cool.
I actually believe like some of the actors who are in like in the firehouse scene, were actual firefighters. I believe they used like real firefighters to do acting on the side in those scenes.
Yeah, I did read that in one of the articles I read about this movie. Yeah, there are a lot of genuine firefighters in this movie. And, you know, and of course, Steve Buscemi also has experience in that area. He apparently, according to the IMDb trivia page, he was taking acting classes after about a year on the job, and he stayed with the FDNY while acting in plays and movies. So,
oh, far out.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, I mean, I also greatly understand the firefighter culture because, I mean, I watched all the seasons of Rescue Me, so I get it.
You get it.
No, I get it. I mean, you know, I watched Dennis Leary pretend to run into fires for about 5 or 6 years. So, I mean, I'm down with the firefighters.
You rented Backdraft. You know the story.
Exactly.
You haven't seen it, but you will.
Yeah, no, Ron Howard would not lie to me. I mean, I am sure that Kurt Russell and William Baldwin accurately captured the full firefighter experience. I mean, I watched Turk 182. I know what the deal is.
You watch Ghostbusters. That took place in a firehouse.
Right, yeah, they slid down poles. They're like Batman.
They had that one song by the Busboys play as they went to the hotel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I get it. I am down with the firefighters.
What are you supposed to be, some type of cosmonaut?
Well, we're exterminators. Somebody spotted a roach on 12.
It must be one big roach.
Bite your head off, pal.
Oh, God. Oh, I can't wait till we do the Ghostbusters episode.
Ghostbusters eventually. We are. We're just waiting for the new movie to hit.
We will do it. And when we're waiting to do it. We want to do it justice. That's why it will be done.
We have Ghostbusters plans. We know. We know. We're getting to it.
Absolutely. Big plans.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. So, as the time goes on, we see Ray and Margie getting closer. And then they decide to take a trip up to Claire's college to visit her. And Claire is with her high school friend who's also at the college, Joni. And this is something else I didn't know, but Joni is played by Pauline Chalamet. Sister of a one Timothy Chalamet.
Oh, look at that!
How about that?
All sorts of people related to famous people are in this movie.
All types of nepotism in this film.
I mean, since we're coming back to her character, how did you think Maude Apatow was in this movie as Scott's sister Claire?
Oh, I thought she was okay. Like, yeah. I mean. Yeah, I thought it was fine. Like, I guess what Claire's her big motivation was that she was worried that, like, when she left college and you know when she left the house, like all of Scott's crazy energy and all of his you know irrationalities would hit you know would go to the mom, and like, like I think she felt like I'm here to deflect all of Scott's madness, but like once I leave, then it's just gonna be him and mom in the house, and like that's going to kind of mess up the house. So I think that was like her main worry about it. But then,
yeah.
So then like when they go visit her at college, I think, you know, one of Scott's big, what Scott wants to do is like break them up. It's like, oh, we got to break up Mom and Ray. But like Claire's like, no, Ray's a good guy. I don't see what's the problem.
Yeah. It seems fine. I'm happy she has somebody and all that. And Scott's just, he's very down on it. He's like, no, she needs to like date around and find somebody. She shouldn't just get together with the first guy she's dated in 17 years. And I mean, it's just really obvious that Scott just resents this guy just kind of beyond all reason. Cause I mean, you know, Ray seems like a good guy at heart and he is really trying.
Yeah. It's like a, this boy's life type of vibe, but not quite.
Yes, I will agree with not having seen This Boy's Life. I believe it involves Robert De Niro beating up a young Leonardo DiCaprio, right?
Okay, this is where I admit I've never seen This Boy's Life either.
All right. So between the two of us, we can agree this movie is just like This Boy's Life.
Yes, this movie is just like a movie. This is just like a movie neither one of us has seen. I just knew there was like a stepfather involved who was like trying to muscle in between a mom and his son. So I was like, this analogy plays.
So it's exactly the same. I mean, this movie, essentially a remake of This Boy's Life.
It's exactly like a movie I've never seen.
Yep, yep. Co-signed.
So, I mean, what else happened? Oh, so also at one point, I don't know, maybe we can get into this, but you know, Scott and his friends Oscar and Igor and Richie, they're kind of low level.
Remember them?
Yeah,
we're back.
Back to them. They're kind of like low level, you know, drug dealers. Oscar's basically like a drug dealer. Like he'll sell like oxy to kids out of his place, and he has this like idea of like, oh, like we can knock. I see this far. I know this one pharmacy where we can like go and steal the oxy and get out and sell it and make some money, and like he wants to get all of his buddies in. All his buddies are down with it.
It's a perfect plan, really.
Yeah. Full proof.
Full proof. And they rope Scott in to be their lookout.
Right. At first, Scott doesn't want to do it. He's out. But then, like, once they come, I think, on the ride, coming back from the college visiting his sister, he, like, kind of pretends to be asleep. And then he hears his mom and Ray talking. And they talk about him, like, how about how he's, like, has no ambition. He just has no confidence. Mm-hmm. And they're worried about him, but the words upset Scott so much that he decides to go along with this heist.
Yeah, so he decides, you know, do the big score, and then, you know, you can get going to life. He can start up his tattoo restaurant idea or whatever he wants to do with that money.
Yeah, that's a thing. That's another thing about his tattoo restaurant idea. He doesn't do anything to really, like, try to make it come to fruition. It's just an idea, but he doesn't, like, look into what goes into starting a business. He doesn't really look into, like, trying to make his dream a reality. It's just like, oh, yeah, I could do a tattoo restaurant. And that's it.
Well, and you know, and there's a scene at some point in the movie where he's basically goes to local tattoo parlor, and he's talking to the tattoo artist, and he's like, hey, did you look at my book? Did you want to take me on as an apprentice? And at first the guy's like, well, I can take you on as an apprentice, but you'll just be doing like grunt work. You'll be like cleaning the needles. You'll be taking out the garbage. You'll be doing this, and you won't touch anybody until I say you're ready. And this isn't what Scott wants to hear. And he like starts being a dick. Basically, he starts like insulting all the tattoos on the guy that the tattoo artist is working on. He's like, oh, well, you know, what if somebody came in and wanted you to do a ghost with a Confederate flag on him? Would you do that? And, you know, what if he did want to do another tattoo that was memorializing his dead friend? Would you do that? And he basically gets chased out of there because he's being such a jerk.
Yeah. Like, again, he's very combative, Scott. He's very like in your, he goes from 0 to 100 real quick. Also the tattoo artist was played by a rapper and artist or a actor, Machine Gun Kelly.
Oh, nice. Nice. That is cool. That is cool. Let me just say, this is a scene where there is a tattoo customer and he's got like a Confederate flag tattooed on him, and he is not the least sympathetic person in the scene. So,
yeah.
Tells you how much of a jerk Scott is being at that moment in time.
He's a man with a Confederate flag tattoo in Staten Island.
Yes, yes, on his right pec. Prominent spot. That's. I don't know a whole lot about tattoos. I don't have any tattoos myself, but that seems like prominent tattoo placement.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first place you look.
Right, right. You go to the right pec, then you go to the left pec. You're like, oh, Confederate ghost, then dead friend. Okay, yes, all right. I see the hierarchy here.
Spectacles, tentacles, wallet, and watch.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, so the tattoo artist dream isn't quite happening,
right?
And so we have the big heist where they try to knock over the pharmacy, and Scott's friends go in, and it seems to be going well at first. They're finding all the OxyContin they want, you know. It's going to be a big score, and just then the owner comes out.
Yeah,
and he's like, no, I've been robbed 2 times before. I'm not having it anymore. And
and the owner and his wife, played by, did you know that, or?
Yeah, Robert Smigel and Jessica Curzon.
Damn straight.
So, two more people from the comedy world.
Right.
So, a lot of good people. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So basically Scott, his, you know, the one thing he had to do was be a lookout. He didn't quite look out.
Yeah, what their system that they developed was Scott was supposed to send a text to the guy's phone just saying "you up." That was going to be their code to, like, if he spotted somebody and they needed to get out of there. And he's like, "Oh, do I have to send you that? That sounds like I'm trying to hook up with you." And then when Scott, he's like playing games on his phone. He's not really doing his job. But when he finally realizes, when he hears gunshots and he finally realizes, oh, this thing is going south, he's like, he's frantically sending texts like, "Wanna fuck? Wanna fuck? Wanna fuck?" to convey the seriousness of, you need to get out of there. Are you okay?
It took him gunshots to realize, oh, wait, this ain't good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, so the cops come to the pharmacy and Scott's friends get busted, but Scott manages to get away. He runs off into the night.
Right. And, he makes it by the skin of his teeth. And,
And this is the part, if I remember correctly, this is the part where, like, Scott kind of has it out with Ray.
Basically he has it out with Ray because he still wants to get rid of Ray and he's still trying to, break up Ray and his mom. So
Before that, he bonds with Ray's ex-wife.
Yes. Like, there's a scene where he walks to Ray's ex-wife's house to bond. Did you think, like, I thought, because for a minute, like, when...
I totally thought he was going to bang Ray's ex-wife.
Right? Thank you.
I totally thought that.
That's the first thing I thought. I was like, oh, is he going to smash? He's trying to bone?
Yeah. Yeah, because I think your mind goes to, like, okay, what is the worst, most damaging thing he could do in this moment? And it would be, he would try to bang his mom's current boyfriend's ex-wife.
Right.
Yeah.
But the movie does not go that way. They do not bone.
No. Instead, they get drunk on wine. They get high together, and he just gets Ray's ex-wife to trash talk Ray, and he finds out all this stuff. She's like, "Oh, well, he was a gambler, and he like blew all our money on gambling, and he's a horrible dad. He's trying to not get custody of the kids, and all this stuff."
She also says, like, he's homeless. He basically lives at the firehouse. He has no home.
Right, because he and at one point, Scott says, "Well, how big of a dipshit do you have to be to not afford rent in Staten Island? It's so cheap here." And he has so little self-awareness, he doesn't realize that this also applies to him. Because by this point, his mom has asked him, you gotta move out by the end of the summer. Because, like, things with Ray are going well, and you can't be here forever.
Yeah. And, I mean, that was a good line, like, about how... I guess it is cheaper. I haven't looked into rent in Staten Island, but I imagine it's a little bit cheaper. Because, I mean, for those that don't know... In the five boroughs, Staten Island is kind of low on the totem pole, as it were.
Scott and his friends, they have a conversation early on about how, like, various other New York areas and neighborhoods have gotten gentrified, like Brooklyn and Williamsburg and, like, all this stuff. And they're like, Staten Island's next. Staten Island's on the way up. This is, where it's going to happen to us next. And
But in the meantime,
In not the best place.
I really, like, I've lived in New York City my whole life. Like, I was, born and raised. But I've never been to Staten Island until I was, like, I'm going to say, like, 27, 28. Like, I had to go there for work.
Yeah.
It's just, like, I mean, for those that don't know, like, as far as the five boroughs go, it's, like, Brooklyn and Queens are, like, the popular kids in school. Like, everybody wants to go there. Everybody, wants to be their friend. Everybody, they're the prom king and queen. And, like, Queens is, like, in the middle. It's, like, it's not... You don't totally... What was that?
I'm sorry. I just wanted to sing One Headlight. That's the lyric I know from One Headlight.
Oh, God damn it. That's a... Well done, sir. Well done. But, yeah, like, Queens is, like, right in the middle. And it's, like, it's not as popular and poppin' as Brooklyn and Queens, but it's not as, it's fine. And, like... But the Bronx and Staten Island are the misfit kids. They're like if you tell somebody you live in the Bronx or Staten Island, they look down on you like ew.
Aww.
It's true. I'm telling you, it's true. We may lose our Bronx Staten Island fan base from this, but they know.
This has been Borough Beat with Jaron
Patterson. Find me on Twitter at DanCredible. Tweet all. Like, even at, there's one line in the movie that I thought was great, where it's like, Staten Island is the only place that Jersey looks down on.
Yes, yes, that was a good line. That was a good line.
And it's true.
I've never been to Staten Island. I know a couple people who live in Staten Island, but that is about the extent of my knowledge. They both are very nice. So yes.
It's a weird place. I'll just say that. It's like it's a perfect mix of like Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, Long Island, and Jersey. So it's I don't know. It is what it is.
Yep. Scott, of course, he has all this dirt on Ray now, so he goes to his mother and he lets her know all about it in the hopes of sabotaging their burgeoning relationship.
Right.
And it's pretty successful.
Yeah, Ray confronts him immediately saying, what are you doing talking to my ex-wife, telling, finding all this bad stuff about me? Like, what the hell is that? You know, you're trying to break, I got a good thing going with your mom. I like her. She likes me. And of course, Scott being extremely combative just gets right in his face, like, you're a piece of shit. You're a fucking psycho. Get out. We don't want you in our family. Everything was going great till you got here. And then just get into this big scuffle, which ends up with Ray throwing Scott into a pool.
An above ground pool, yes.
Yeah,
Island.
Yeah, above ground pool, of course, Staten Island. Yeah. Classy.
Yeah. And he's like, "You tried to drown me." And Bill Burr just goes, "It's an above ground pool, and you're like 8 feet tall."
Yeah, I forget how tall Pete is. He's like 6'3" or something. He's
6'3", I believe. Yeah.
Good gravy.
Tall guy. Tall, lanky guy.
Yeah. So then after this, Margie comes in, sees what they've been doing. She's angry with both of them. She kicks Ray out, and she kicks Scott out. So, like, both of them are just on the outs with her.
They are in the doghouse. So
right. So
not going well. We've reached kind of a crisis point.
Yeah. So at this point, like, Scott literally has no place to live. He goes,
"I got no place else to go."
I got no place else to go. So he goes visits his.
Not however, join the Marines. Just to clarify.
Gotcha. Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're doing there. Yeah. So he goes visits his friend Oscar, who's in prison, who's got arrested. I think they say they only got like 3 to 5 months.
And he's visiting his boys in prison, and he actually asks one of his friends. He's like, "Hey, since you're here for the next few months, can I crash at your place?"
Which is, I mean,
some balls. On one hand, you can see his logic.
Yeah, I mean, his house is just sitting there.
Right. I mean, it may as well go to use, right?
Yeah. Need somebody to feed that cat.
Yeah. It's like, "Hey, you got busted for that DWI. Anybody driving your car for the next few months?"
I know it's supposed to be a lookout on that that thing we did, that heist, and I didn't do that. But can I stay at your apartment while you're in prison?
I know I'm like at least half the reason you're in here, but
now hear me out.
So
and so Oscar says no, don't stay at my house. So then of course Scott goes to Kelsey, they hook up again. Of course she wants to be like a meaningful relationship between them. She wants their friends to know that they've been dating and boyfriend, girlfriend and everything. And he's not really ready to say that yet, but he is ready to ask if he could crash on her couch for a while and stay over there.
Yeah. And then she was like, "Did you really just hook up with me just so you could ask for a place to crash?" And he's like, no. And he kind of did. And then when that's a no-go, he's like, "Well, could I stay in your brother's room?" And she's like, "He's 14. And Scott's like, "He's got bunk beds."
He's living the life.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, that doesn't go well either. And he gets kicked out of that house. So... much like Felix Unger, with no place else to go, he goes
to the apartment of his friend Oscar Madison, several years before his wife had also asked him to leave and never return. Can two divorced men share an apartment without driving each other crazy?
Da-da-da-da-da!
Okay.
Well, wait, what were we talking about? Oh, yeah. So
I don't know. I just you gave me a cue on The Odd Couple, and my mind just went to a place. So
well played, sir. Well done. I get thank you for the assist, John Trumbull.
Yeah.
Yay!
All right. So yeah. So what actually happens is Scott goes to the firehouse where Ray works. He asks to stay there. You know, because like it's literally the only place he could think of where he could crash.
And you know, hey, they've already got one squatter, so you know, what's one more?
Yeah, of course. Ray says, "What are you doing here? You're the reason you broke up. You know, you broke up. You broke up the thing I was having with me and your mom. Like that was a really shitty thing to do. Like you went to my ex-wife. You mixed it to one person who would say all these horrible things about me. You didn't go to my coworkers here, my firefighters. They would have said great things about me. You just went to Like you said."
And he's got a point.
Yeah. Like you set me up. That's a shitty thing you did and you know it. And then, of course, Scott says, well, the way I figure it, like, if you let me stay here, like, and, you know, my mom sees that you're being nice to me, that's a way to maybe get back in the good graces with her. And this is literally the last card I have to play. So,
yeah.
He figured, all right, you could stay here.
And he's like, yeah, I'd be doing a mitzvah. So, he likes to stay.
L'chaim.
and then like the movie sort of takes a turn. It kind of becomes about Scott staying at the firehouse and kind of learning the ropes of how the firehouse operates. And he's doing stuff like cleaning the truck and helping keep the firehouse up and all that. So he's learning some responsibility and learning some pride and self-esteem and all that good stuff.
Yeah, scrubbing toilets and whatnot. Because like they basically, the firefighters say, look, you can stay here, but you ain't staying here for free. You got to do something.
You got to earn your keep.
Exactly.
You got to earn your keep. You got to you know, do the laundry and learn about bed bugs. And
Great scene. Again, another New York comic. That bed bug scene was with Mike Vecchione, another New York comic.
Yep. So bit by bit, we see Scott. He's kind of getting his shit together, and he and Ray kind of reconcile, and then Ray eventually becomes fond enough of Scott. He's like, well, you know what? You want to be a tattoo artist? And Ray sees he sees a drawing that Scott did for one of his kids, that he did for his kid Harold. Harold's into this superhero named Ice Flash, who has like ice and freezing powers. By the way, Ice Flash, not a real superhero, and not a very good superhero name, by the way.
Ice Flash is...
Ice Flash, let's...
Yeah, I feel like the copyright people from The Flash would, like, get involved in that.
Well, yeah, and also the character... We see Scott's drawing of the character. The character is basically Iceman. I mean, like, no two ways about it. I mean, he's just a man covered in ice. It is Iceman from the X-Men.
Oh, boy. Marvel sending a cease and desist.
Yeah, I guess they were like, well, let's not bother trying to get rights to the real character, you know, from Marvel and Disney, and let's not spend more than 5 minutes trying to think of a better name than Ice Flash. But
it's like, all right, it works. Ice Flash, yeah. Sure.
But anyway, but Ray sees this drawing that Scott did, and he's like, oh, wow, this kid actually has some talent, and, you know, maybe I should encourage him more. And so he says, well, tell you what, none of your friends want to let you practice doing tattoos on them anymore. You can do a tattoo on me. You can do a tattoo on my back. I'm never going to see it. I don't care. You do whatever you want.
Right, because I think, I mean, that happens after a few things happen, like where they let Scott come with them on a ride to, like, a fire, and then...
Yeah.
Like Scott sees like what goes into being a firefighter, and then afterwards they go to a bar for drinks, and then they yes.
All right, they sing along to the Wallflowers' "One Headlight," and
they do that. Yeah,
it's a big scene in the trailer, you know, and like all everyone's go
in the middle. All right, what was it gonna say? So then after the fire, they kind of have this little bonding moment where they all go to a bar, and because a lot of the firefighters, especially Steve Buscemi's character Papa, knew Scott's dad. His dad, they call it, his name is Stan in the movie. They're like, oh yeah, like your dad was hilarious. He was you know, he was crazy, but he was like really charming. And they tell stories about his dad doing coke with them and like doing all the off the wall shit.
Yeah, so I mean, Pete, he kind of gains a new perspective about his dad, and he and Ray have bonded more, and he's practicing his tattooing on Ray, and then we have a scene towards the end where all the firefighters in the house, they're out on a call, and then this guy comes by when Scott's just kind of minding the store, and he's this heavyset guy who's bleeding.
Yes, the heavyset guy, played by another rapper, Action Bronson.
That's an awesome name. That's a sweet, sweet name.
Yeah, it's pretty dope. I actually like his stuff quite a bit. Like, I'm a fan of Action Bronson. His rhyming style is kind of like old school 90s, and the beat sounds like, you know, 90s hip-hop. So, like, I dig his stuff. But, if you don't know Action Bronson, I highly recommend you look up his stuff. He's also has, like a travel food show on Viceland called Fuck That's Delicious, because
I love that. That's awesome.
I'm not even making that up. It's called Fuck That's Delicious because, like, I think he used to be a chef, so he's like, he really loves good foods, and he has a show called Fuck That's Delicious.
I love that. That's such a cool combo, rapping and like the food.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah, and I believe he's also in The Irishman too, which came out earlier, like last year.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Well, go Action Bronson.
Yeah. It's a dope name.
Dope name.
So anyway, like, he walks up to Scott, he's bleeding from his gut. And like Scott keeps asking, "Oh my god, what happened?" He's like, "Oh, you know, I fell in a thorn bush, a vape exploded in my pocket. I don't know."
So he tells like literally a different story every time he is asked. So we never really find out what exactly happened to the dude.
Right. So like Scott sees this guy needs help. So he like, he puts him in one of the fire trucks, not the truck, but like, fire SUV, I guess it's called. And like, he drives him to the hospital, and then they're waiting in the waiting room. And that's when the guy's saying things like, "Hey, do me a favor. Can we exchange identities? Real quick."
So you know, however this guy got injured, it was something shady. I mean, yeah, because
absolutely.
So I don't think it's as simple as like he just didn't have insurance and he's doing like that Friends episode of where Monica and Rachel are like, "Hey, can you? I'm Rachel Green. I'm Monica Geller," and then the two doctors played by George Clooney and Noah Wiley are like, "Hey, what? You're not Rachel. You're not Monica." But they're not playing their characters from ER. It's weird because they're doctors in New York and ER was in Chicago, and it's a whole weird thing.
I had no idea until just now you were such a Friends aficionado, my friend.
I watched the first season. Yeah, I watched it. You know,
but you had that information off the rip. You had that ready.
I did.
Oh, interesting. All right.
I have many sides to me, Darren Patterson.
Wow, you're complicated. You're like a riddle wrapped in a rhyme.
I'm a complicated man, and nobody understands me but my lady.
Hush your mouth.
I'm just talking about the first season of Friends.
And we can dig it. at this point, Ray was called, so Ray meets up with Scott at the hospital. They both take in the guy. It's a hospital that Margie works at, because Margie's a nurse. And so they're looking at the guy. And this is like the first time in a long time that both Ray and Margie and Scott have been together in the same room. All Scott and Ray are covered in the dude's blood, so they have to like take off their shirts, you know, because they're covered in blood. And that's when Margie sees the back tattoo that Scott's drew on him. And like at first you see stuff that's like he has like a picture of like a childish drawing, like Old Dirty Bastard at one point, and there's like Chinese lettering, even though Ray specifically asked, "Don't put any Chinese lettering on my back."
Yeah,
he's basically using his back as like a scribble pad. And but
it's a smorgasbord of mediocre tattoos.
Yeah. There's like a dragon. This was an interesting thing they did too, because like I thought like the final tattoo would be like this really beautiful, amazing thing, and it turned out not so much.
No, he is still not a very good tattoo artist.
Nope. But I mean, at the top, you know, of his back, you see that he tattooed this picture of Ray and him and his mom and his sister all together. Uh-huh. And then, like, in the corner, there's a picture of his dad, like, kind of looking down on them as, like, the son. So, like, there's a very sweet tone to it. Like,
yeah, yeah. And that kind of leads to Margie and Ray reconciling.
Right. And then, you know, it seems like Scott and Margie are on better terms, too. Even, actually, at one point in the movie, like, after he had worked at the firehouse for, like a week or so, he goes back home and he's like, yeah, Ma, I've been working there, like, a week. I think I'm ready to come back home, so maybe I can move back in and whatnot. And then Mom is like, yeah, no, get out.
Yeah, I mean, she is, like, literally laughing at her child. She's like, no, that is not going to happen. And she, like, locks her son out of the house.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. So then after that hospital scene, he's watching Game of Thrones with his mom, which is something she asked to do with him earlier in the movie. But, you know, he didn't want to do it because he'd already seen it. But, like, now they're... And they have, like, this really kind of sweet moment where he's, like, apologizing to, you know, his mom for his past behavior. Like, he's just like, I really, like, miss dad. It's been a lot harder than I thought it'd be. I think, you know, it's been hard for me to be the way I am. I think it'll always be hard. And I think Pete Davidson did some really good acting here.
Yeah. I was pretty impressed with Pete Davidson throughout the film. I thought he did a really nice job.
Yeah. So then we see this tender moment between Scott and his mom, where they're kind of reconciling. They kind of leave it up in the air. Like, I don't think he moves back in to the mom. I think he's just at the firehouse, but it's never really clear.
They do leave, yeah, certain things kind of up in the air. Because, I mean, as you might have guessed from hearing us, like, summarize this movie and kind of bouncing all around with it, this movie has a lot of plots. It's got a lot of balls in the air. I mean, we got the tattoo artist thing. We got the firefighter thing. We got the mom dating again thing. We got his sister going off to college thing. We got his friends getting busted for trying to rob a pharmacy thing. I mean, it's got a lot in there.
It's an Apatow film. It's always going to be more than you need. Like, it's the thing with him.
Yeah. It's an Apatow film, and his films, and I couch this criticism by saying I do like Judd Apatow, and I enjoy watching his films, and I enjoy seeking out what he does next. But I think it's safe to say that most of his films are about 20 minutes too long.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think you just gotta kind of make peace with it, because, like, I know it's something he knows he does. Like, he'll just go 20 minutes long, but he's aware of the criticism, but he doesn't care. That's what he wants.
He doesn't, you know, he's just like, if you're enjoying it, more of it is a good thing. Yeah, I'm more of the school, like, it's good to leave him wanting more. But, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I think you could cut to a couple things that you could cut, possibly. I mean, like, at the end of the film, like, you know, his friend's still in jail. We don't know what's going to happen to them, so.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there was some stuff, like the whole restaurant stuff, there's one scene where we see, like, at the end of the night, the waiters and stuff, they, like, kind of fight it out for the tips. They put on, like, these big Hulk gloves and, like, kind of like, fight out. Like, that, I mean, it's a cute scene, but it doesn't really add much to the story.
Yeah, and it doesn't contribute to the plot. The restaurant thing doesn't pay off in a big way. So it's just like, well, yeah, why do we do that? And I understand that is a story that is drawn from Pete Davidson's life. They said, like he said, he worked in a restaurant where they actually had to do that. And I think that was their way of settling any resentments that arose during a shift. But Pete Davidson said, like, at the end of, like, a 7 or 8 hour shift, you're not really that mad about that thing anymore. So it's like, wait, why are we fighting?
Yeah, it's like, I want to go home. But yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's just, at this point, like, Apatow movies are going to be 20 minutes too long. Like, if you watch a Tarantino film, you're going to see bare feet. If you watch an Apatow film, it's going to be too long. It's just, you got to deal with it.
It's, yeah, if you watch a Marvel movie that's directed by the Russo brothers, a cast member from Community is going to make a cameo appearance.
That's a good thing.
Yes, that is a very good thing. That is not a thing you have to tolerate. That is a thing you anticipate.
Yeah!
I want to see Kong in a bad mustache rescuing Paul Rudd from the microverse.
Oh, my God. From your lips to God's ears.
Yeah.
All right. So we're at the end of the movie now. So at this point, we see that Ray drops off Scott at the Staten Island ferry port, because Scott wants to kind of make amends with Kelsey, and he sees Kelsey at the Staten Island ferry, I guess port, I guess it's called, and Kelsey's like, well, I'm on my way to take my civil service exam because throughout the movie, Kelsey has like a lot of pride in Staten Island. She really wants to see it become bigger and better. So she said she wants to take her civil service exam so she shows she can become a city planner. So at this point, Scott's like, well, can I come with you to the exam? She's like, oh yeah, that'd be great. So on the way to the, because they're taking the ferry into the city, at that point, Scott helps her study a little bit for the exam. And then he tells her, you know, I really do. I love you. I've always loved you. I just always felt like I wasn't good enough for you. And, you know, yeah. I'm sorry for everything I put you through.
Yeah, which kind of calls back to an early scene in the movie when we first see them hooking up. And, you know, we realize, like, Scott explains a little about himself, and we see that he's got some serious self-esteem problems. And I like that that Kelsey, at one point, she's like, well, yeah, you should be glad you're hooking up with me. I'm awesome. And I'm like, oh, wow. He's like so... She's so centered, and she knows herself, and she's like can speak well of herself. And I'm like, well, what's that like?
Confidence like?
Yeah, but she's like, oh, I hate that you can't see that you're a cool guy, and that was a really affecting scene,
So after they have a kiss, and they seem to have made amends. So the final scene. They're in downtown Manhattan, like near City Hall area. Scott walks Kelsey to the place where she's going to take her exam. Kelsey's like, "Hey, can you wait for me until I'm done so we can take a ferry back?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, sure, no problem. Like, how long will you be?" And she's like, like 3.5 hours."
Yeah,
and he's like, "Yeah, that's fine. I'll like walk around the city or something." And
yeah.
And then that's pretty much it. Like, I mean, that's my one big criticism. I thought like the ending was a little anticlimactic.
It's kind of an open ending. Actually, I understand it, I think, a little better now. I saw on the IMDb trivia, it says, during the final scene, Kelsey enters the David and Dinkins Municipal Building in Manhattan. As Scott walks away from the entrance, he stops and looks up into the sky in the direction where the Twin Towers used to stand. It's a tribute to Pete Davidson's father, Scott Davidson, who, of course, was a firefighter who died on 9/11.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure that's the reason why they named his character Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we have a nice picture of real life Scott Davidson holding a young Pete Davidson as soon as the movie ends, which was a nice way to end it.
Okay. Yeah, because I was wondering like why I was wondering why there wasn't like a bigger ending. Like maybe I thought, oh, why didn't he just go to Ground Zero or something like that? Because like. Where he was in downtown Manhattan, Ground Zero is like only a few minutes away. But then I remembered that they were trying to stay away from it being about 9/11 and whatnot, and just being about loss and getting over that loss and grief.
Yeah. It was about his personal loss and not the bigger loss of 9/11. So I think that subtle acknowledgement was a nice way to do it. But it is a low key kind of ending. I mean, you feel like he's going to get his shit together, but you don't really know it. And you're only seeing the very beginning of the process. So,
yeah. But I mean, maybe that was the point that like, changes in someone's life doesn't happen like in big, big bursts or, it's like incremental growth.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a continuous journey. It's not like you do one big thing and then everything's okay. So it's a more true to life type ending, I think.
Yeah, I would say so. Like, that's the one thing about this whole movie. It was way more like darker and more serious than I thought it'd be. And like you said, like more true to life. Because I mean, usually Apatow films are a joke a minute. They're more a little bit more lighter. And this one was like, way more heavier than I expected.
Yeah, I feel kind of the same. I wasn't really expecting it to be like wacky or anything. I knew there was going to be some dramatic stuff mixed in, but yeah, the balance was definitely tilted more towards the drama. But I still enjoyed it. I think it's worthwhile seeing. I think P. Pete Davidson gives a great performance. Bill Burr was terrific. Marissa Tomei was very good. She could have had a little more. I definitely could have done with some more Steve Buscemi.
We always need more Buscemi.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you are ever doubting if you should add more Steve Buscemi to your movie, the answer is always yes.
It's like cheese on pasta. Just add more.
Yes. Yes. 100%.
Pile on that Parmesan.
Pile on that Buscemi.
Pile on that Buscemi.
Yep.
But yeah, I think it's a great film. Really, really good and highly recommended.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good stuff.
Yeah, and that's our film. That's our review, guys. That's it. That's all we got. And I guess maybe we'll talk about what we're going to do next, the next episode.
Yes. The next film we're doing, it's interesting in that it is kind of an obscure film, but it is a very notable film in SNL history because it led directly or indirectly to a cast member departing the show.
Yeah, we're gonna get into this one. This is interesting. but yeah, we're gonna talk about the film Killing Gunther, written and directed by Taron Killam on Netflix right now.
Yeah. So, and this is of course the why Taron Killam ended up leaving SNL. He actually got fired.
Yeah, this was really interesting because I still remember when. Like him and Jay Farrow got fired at the same time, and like it really came out of nowhere. And I don't think I knew the full story. I think afterwards, like Taron kind of talked about it, and he was pretty upfront about it. But like I don't know, like I still want to get to know the whole story. Like there's still like bits and pieces that are still I still don't know about.
Yep. Well, we're gonna find out about it. We're gonna do a deep dive into this, and we're gonna watch this movie. And it's an interesting movie. It's got Taron Killam. It's got his wife Colby Smulders in it, and it has a Mr. Let's see. He's got an interesting name, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Huh.
I hope I'm saying that right.
I mean, with a name like that, I don't think he's gonna make it in this business. He needs to.
No. I mean, can you imagine that name on a movie marquee? No. Yeah. That'll never work.
Run out of letters.
I assume this is just some struggling foreign actor that Taron Killam decided to give a break to, which is really nice. That speaks well of Taron.
He has a big heart. Good.
He does. He's a giver.
Yes. So we're going to talk about Killing Gunther. So, stay tuned. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned for that.
I'm looking forward to it. I like this plan. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Don't give me Ghostbusters. Quotes like, dude, we're about to wrap up this podcast. Like, I come on, so be good for goodness sake.
Whoa, the flowers are still standing.
Dude, the Ghostbusters episode is just gonna be it's gonna be too much,
it's gonna be off the hook, man.
It's gonna make the MacGruber episode look like a mini-sode.
Yeah,
that's a big Twinkie.
Yeah, but anyway, but next week, Killing Gunther, not Ghostbusters, Killing Gunther.
All right, we're going to get to Ghostbusters, I swear, we will.
But, but before we wrap up, we got a nice thing on Facebook from a Mr. Matt Levy. Let me see if I can find that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Shout out to Matt Levy.
Yeah, he did a post a little earlier today as we were recording this. It was just sort of a comedy stray notes. Is what he called, and let me just scroll down in the post to find that he talked about a lot of various things. It was a big week for comedy, you guys.
Yeah, a lot happened. I mean, a lot of other things happened.
Let's just say a lot of people got canceled this week, and thank God we were not one of them.
Oh boy.
Let's see. He says this is just sort of things that he liked and that helped get him through the week, and he says. SNL Nerds' Dave Cirrus episode. So I had seen King of Staten Island and really admired the direction that Apatow and Pete took. However, you have to acknowledge the third party that helped shape this film, former SNL writer and NYC comic Dave Cirrus. I didn't really know his story, but after listening to him speak to hosts Darren Patterson and John Trumbull, I was smiling ear to ear. Hearing his comedy origin story of being a huge SNL fan, and then in parentheses, Anyone that can actually praise 90s SNL movies and find what's good in them is A-OK in my book. Leading to his start in comedy and multiple versions of the Pete movie that didn't pan out, made for a gripping 55-minute listen while I prepared dinner one night. The hosts have a natural rapport and respect for Sirius, and the conversation flowed effortlessly. Give it a listen.
Well, thanks, Matt. And don't forget, you know, you can also leave lovely praise like that on our, on the old iTunes page, and maybe give us a little review there.
Yeah, we always like getting reviews. It's always nice hearing feedback on the show because, I mean, we do this show by ourselves, essentially, and then we put it out there into the world, and we don't hear a whole lot of what people think of it. So we always love getting feedback. We love hearing the good, the bad, like, what do you like? What do you want to see more of? What do you want us to do a little less of? That's good. You know, it helps us figure out how to calibrate this and do the best podcast that we can do.
Yes. Help us guide this ship.
Help us help you. Help us you.
Yeah. And also, as always, you can always, like, you know, donate some dough and donate to our Patreon at non-productive.com.
Yes. Yes. And check out the other shows on the Non-Productive Network. There's a lot of fun stuff to listen. So if you enjoy this show, give some of the other shows on the network a try.
All right.
And thanks, as always, to our producer, Frank Ablawi, who we don't give props to often enough. He really helps make this show happen, and it was his idea that we should do this thing to begin with. And thank you for that, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. You're the wind beneath our wings.
You are. You are. And did we ever tell you that you're our hero?
You're everything that we wish we could be. Wait, what?
Yeah. That's close enough.
All right. I haven't heard that song in a while.
And I don't know it nearly as well as the opening to The Odd Couple. But anyway, you can follow the show page on at SNL Nerds Show on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Trumbull Comic. That is TRUMBULL and the word comic.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N Credible.
Okay, and is there anything else we need to cover before we sign off?
No, I think I'm good, man.
I think I'm good. All right. You're good. I'm good. So until next week, Nerds out!
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Ablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.